Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Sunday, February the 9th. And as we like to do on Sundays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. An amazing week for President Trump, perhaps the greatest week of his presidency. You had the acquittal, you had the State of the Union, you had a decision made by a judge there at the end of the week, basically stopping a lot of these crazy investigations, at least some of them coming out of the state of New York. Speaker Pelosi provoked a lot of reaction when she tore up the speech. I thought that was absolutely incredible. Iowa went completely wrong for the Democrats. I mean, it was just insane. Now they have a primary in New Hampshire, I believe, on Tuesday. The city of New York is having a crime problem with police being shot at. So lots to get into with our friend Bill this week. How are you, Bill? It's a little rainy here in Dallas, but other than that, it's great.
Well, there was sunshine here in New York, and I think sunshine in many conservative hearts this week, because the Democratic Party gave us a week of lessons in how not to do things. And I think it is now even grudgingly admitted by mm-hmm. some liberal columnists that the Democratic Party is really a mess.
It sure is. I mean, we'll get into a lot of that. A lot of that tonight, but they're in deep trouble, and I think, as you say, a lot of Democrats are starting to figure it out. But let me begin with the passing of a gentleman who I loved reading his books, certainly The Boys of Summer, written in the 1970s, Roger Kahn, who passed away. He was 92 or 93. I remember reading that book, The Boys of Summer, and I thought it was one of the finest books I've ever read. It was just a book I recommend to anybody, Bill.
I'm holding a copy right now. It was coming, came right off my bookshelf. I interviewed Roger Kahn for The Tonight Show, and it was one of the most pleasant afternoons I'd ever spent, because I had been a Brooklyn Dodger fan. And when I interviewed him, it was, well, now probably 15 or so years after the Dodgers left Brooklyn, which was a very much a traumatizing experience for many people. People don't realize that the Dodgers symbolized Brooklyn. There was probably no more institution that was more famous about Brooklyn than the Brooklyn Dodgers. And they upped and went to Los Angeles because of disagreements over building a new stadium in New York. It used to be said in New York that people in Brooklyn had three public enemies: Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Walter O'Malley, who was the head of the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I think that was true. I think it was considered a great betrayal of a town that had given the Dodgers such name recognition over the years and such a support over the years, and they just left. And I think that was, in a way, the beginning of the decline of modern baseball, that, loyalty meant so much. The New York Giants also left New York to go to San Francisco, but the Giants never had the following here that the Brooklyn Dodgers had, even though they had a great following. They played at the Polo Grounds. I went to games at the Polo Grounds. But Ebbets Field was torn down. People would pick up a newspaper and see pictures of things they had seen since their youth being carted away on trucks. There is a plaque now where home plate was, and it's a housing development, a predominantly African-American housing development, and all that's left is that plaque. And there were such great days there, and days that went beyond Brooklyn. We lived on Long Island. Well, we moved from Brooklyn to Long Island, and when the Dodgers were in a World Series, they would stop classes and they would put it on the loudspeaker. I mean, that's how important the Brooklyn Dodgers were. I remember in 1951 when Bobby Thompson hit what was called the shot heard around the world to win the pennant for the New York Giants. They hit the home run off Ralph Branca, number 13 for the Brooklyn Dodgers. I was in a math class. We heard it. My next class was gym. And we all gathered around, and the coach went out and talked about it and philosophically and said, I know how many of you are disappointed, and well, there's luck and there's skill and all that, the kind of things coaches usually say, but I remember it to this day. And Roger Kahn chronicled the Brooklyn Dodgers extraordinarily well by telling us what happened after baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Some went on to, you know, reasonable careers. Men in baseball were not paid anywhere near the salaries
mm-hmm.
they're paid today. I mean, they would not have recognized the game today. When a player was given a day, as Pee Wee Reese was, who was the Dodger shortstop and captain of the team, when he was given a day, he was given a Pontiac. He wasn't given a Mercedes. Today, they wouldn't even ride in a Pontiac. I mean,
right.
it's a completely changed game. And some went on to successful careers. Some failed. They didn't have very much money. Carl Furillo, the great right-hander, right fielder, who was called the Reading Rifle because he came from Reading, Pennsylvania. He
right.
Became a construction worker, and he worked on the World Trade Center.
Yes.
And others faded into oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
Some had businesses. Pee Wee Reese, I identified before as the team captain, opened up a car dealership, I think in his native state of Kentucky. Many of them didn't come from New York. Most
right.
of them didn't come from New York. Some stayed in baseball. Gil Hodges stayed in baseball and became the manager of the new New York Mets, but very tragically, he died of a heart attack at a very early age. I believe he was in his 40s when he died
yes.
of a heart attack. And a very, very fine man. Roy Campanella, as we know, went on to tragedy in an automobile
mm-hmm.
accident, which left him paralyzed. And that's the way we saw Roy for the rest of his life.
And Campanella's, Bill, if I may just interrupt you for a second, Campanella's accident happened the winter they left. So it was almost
so.
Like, yeah, I mean, here, I think it happened in January of 58. So that would have been the year that they left. So he never got to play in L.A.
No, never played in L.A.
Because of that accident. But I recommend the book, The Boys of Summer. It's a baseball, it's one of those books that you don't have to be a devout baseball fan to enjoy the book. I think it's just a great book. It's a little bit like that other book that came out recently, totally different topic, but called Moneyball, which was a baseball
yes,
book
right.
about the business of the game. And these are books that you can read without necessarily being a devout baseball fan. But I know, Bill, that you were a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. So Roger Kahn wrote other books, too, as I recall, because I saw him on TV a couple of times. And he did write other baseball books.
Yes.
Just one more question about Roger Kahn. Was he a reporter with one of the local papers, like
yes.
many of them were?
Yes, he was a reporter, and I believe he was a reporter for two papers, and I can't offhand tell you what they
mm-hmm.
were.
So he covered did he cover the Dodgers
yes,
during
mm-hmm.
the season?
He actually covered the team and traveled with the team. And
wow.
remember, in those days, a Western trip, this shows how parochial New Yorkers are, a Western trip ended in St. Louis.
That's
they called
right.
that a Western trip. And there were no major league teams west of St. Louis. It was a very
yes.
different ball league. There were eight teams in the National League, eight teams in the American League, and, of course, our arch rival in the American League were the New York Yankees, or as we used to call them, gritting our teeth, the best team money could buy, because they were the richest team. And Roger Steele makes the point, I do recall this line from the book, which I haven't read in a long time. He said, to Brooklyn Dodger fans, rooting for the New York Yankees was like rooting for U.S. Steel. that's just the way we saw it.
Yes, that's right. No, it is really a very entertaining book. It's worth reading because it's an easy read. It's the kind of book you can probably read a few nights during the week, and it's not going to – It's not a very heavy book. And this day and age, getting a break from all the crazy stuff coming from our politics, this would be a perfect break for anybody out there who wants to get away from politics. Pick up a copy of The Boys of Summer. I think you'll enjoy it a great deal. Well, getting into our politics, Bill, Let me get to the political stuff in a minute, but New York has been in the news here lately. The shooting of, I think the assassination, actually, of two police officers. And everybody there is pretty uptight and pretty angry about this, and many are blaming the mayor. So I know you wrote a post about this. Wanted to get your take on this whole story, Bill.
Well, fortunately, the officers lived, and, you know, they will eventually recover. They're, I think, out of danger at this point. But, yes, it was an individual who went into a police precinct and shot the lieutenant at the desk. Fortunately, they got him. They got him, and they fortunately got him without killing him. But it was immediately recognized that, and I don't think this is absolutely nailed down, but I think they're 98% sure that he was the same person who a night earlier had tried to assassinate two police officers in their police car, and he shot one of them. He was able to shoot one of them and to seriously wound that officer, but I think that officer was out of danger. But he got away, and they were searching for him throughout the Bronx, one of New York's five boroughs. And the fact is he had just been released from prison on, an attempted murder charge for which he served time. He had been released from prison before on violent charges, and he was still walking the streets. I mean, he served his time. He got out. No apparently checking on him, and he was walking the streets, a walking time bomb, and the time bomb went off. As I said, fortunately, neither of these police officers are apparently in danger of dying, but it has created an uproar in New York because it comes on the heels of a change in New York state law, which is, makes it so easy for people arrested for a crime to go out on bail or on no bail on their own recognizance. And this is supposed to help poor people who get arrested for crimes, including violent crimes. I think the feeling in New York is, and I think even the mayor has kind of acknowledged it now, that this has led to an uptick in crime. Because no matter what you do, you kind of get out of jail for a while. And then, of course, you can disappear. It's a very, very irresponsible law. It is one of these laws that comes from the race industry that the criminal laws disproportionately favor white people, which they actually don't in New York, and that something has to be done. And the result has been a lot of dangerous people walking the streets.
Yeah, well, a lot of this is happening, and you're seeing some of this in blue states. And
yes,
regrettably, New York City is about as blue as it gets. It's very left-wing oriented policies. You're seeing it in California too, and you know, in California they wrote this stupid law, basically making it impossible to be an independent contractor. I mean, it's just crazy stuff.
That's right. I don't quite understand that law, but apparently it's going to affect artists and writers.
Yeah,
and
Uber drivers. I mean,
yes.
Uber drivers, which have become have filled a real niche. When we were in San Francisco over the holidays, I mean, that's how we got around with Uber.
Yeah,
and so it's just crazy stuff that comes from I think a lot of these cities that have gone so far to the left that they're in many ways have become unmanageable, Bill.
Well, that's right, and now there is a new immigration law that's been proposed by the Democrats in the House of Representatives in Washington that would eliminate the whole concept of illegal immigration. That it wouldn't be illegal anymore. I mean, why bother with laws at all?
What about the people who came in legally and had to pay
right.
the price? And,
well,
and that's the part that bothers me. I mean, people who came to the country legally respected the laws, and you know, respecting immigration laws means you got to spend money in documents and
that's
lawyers
right.
and time, and apparently I guess those people don't matter. Kind of reminds me of that incident when Elizabeth Warren was confronted by that gentleman who was saying, what about me, you know, I worked to get my education, I paid for it, you know, am I going to get her? I mean, he was arguing with her because she's going to cancel all kinds of school debt or student debt. And he's saying, what about me? You know, I intentionally didn't get debt, and I did it my own way. I paid for it.
Yeah.
What about me?
this is a party, the Democratic Party, that has been reduced to simply giving out free stuff.
Yes.
And free stuff has a great appeal for some people. But you're quite right about the student loan bill and about the bill that would legalize illegal immigrants. What about the people who came here illegally? What message does that send to them? It sends a message to them that they don't have to follow the laws, that we will eventually get you in and eventually probably welcomed with all kinds of free goods and free services. And it is demoralizing the rest of the country, and properly so. Idea here that and by the way, I should point out before going on to a new subject, whenever these laws are proposed, they're always proposed in the name of, quote, traditionally marginalized people. In other words, if you are a member of an appropriate group, you benefit from the law. If you're not a member of an appropriate group, you don't benefit from the law. And again, that is something that I think people are getting angrier and angrier about. And anger eventually boils over. You know, I always like to say, Silvio, that democracy turns slowly, but when they turn decisively. And I think we may be in a period like that right now. The press will call it fascism, which is one of three words they know. And we may we are getting that backlash that was long in coming. You have situations where kids go to school, they go into deep debt to go to college, and what is taught in 4 years of college? How terrible their country is,
right?
And that the American Revolution was fought for slavery, which it was not. And people are starting to wonder. I think you hear it out loud. Why even bother going to these places?
Right.
And I think this is the beginning of a counter-revolution that may have dramatic effects in the United States.
Well, I think it could conceivably and hopefully, as we're talking off the air, that because we're going to talk about impeachment and the Democrats now, but I think it's time to punish the Democrats for this craziness and to punish them to the point where they're reduced to a minority party that has no influence. And then hopefully the centrist Democrats can put their party back together, and they don't necessarily have to agree with Trump on everything, but at least they don't have to buy into all this craziness that you're hearing from this party. I watched a little bit of that debate the other night, Bill. This is crazy. They're sitting there asking these candidates about the killing of this Soleimani or whatever his name is.
Yes, Soleimani.
And I'm sitting there saying, they're all saying, well, you know, we didn't have information of an imminent threat. What are they supposed to find? Mm-hmm. A note from him saying we're going to kill a bunch of people tomorrow?
Look,
I mean, isn't his track record pretty good evidence of what this guy did, Bill?
Exactly. And you know, it is the idea that at one time in this country, when the president took a military action, the country united behind the president, because you have to at some point trust the president. Mm-hmm. That's why the president was elected. He has information we don't have. And this is part of this Trump derangement syndrome, where
yes,
anything Trump does, they're against. If Trump
right.
if Trump took a glass of water tomorrow, they would
mm-hmm.
say he's using up our resources. You know, I mean, that's just the mentality they have. It's a mentality of pure hatred. And I don't think that is a healthy thing in this country, and I think the people will reject it.
Well, and I think it's driving some of these people just nutty. Absolutely nutty, and they're saying things that I don't understand how they can believe what they're saying. I mean, if you're the president of the United States and they bring you information like this, why wouldn't you take out a guy like this guy? I mean, of course you would.
Sure.
And all of them on that stage would have done the same thing, except they don't have the courage to admit it to a left wing audience. Let's take a little break, and then when we come back, we'll get into all the politics, the impeachment, and State of the Union, and everything else. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Just a quick plug for my friend Carlos Geddes. The music that we play on the show is his music, and we have a link to his website on the show information. Well, Bill, this last week. Honestly, President Trump always has an exciting week. That has been the common denominator of his presidency. But this last one was probably his best week. You know, you had the State of the Union, you had everything that happened with Nancy Pelosi, then you have the acquittal, and then you have a judicial opinion that came out later in the week, probably killing a lot of this crazy stuff coming out of New York to investigate him. But I thought he had a great week, and the Democrats had a very bad week, Bill.
The Democrats had probably the worst week I've seen in recent history in American politics. It was almost an instruction manual of what not to do. If you go through each day of the week, just each day of the week, you have a situation where on Monday night they had the Iowa caucuses, and it was a complete disaster. I mean, they couldn't even count the votes. Reporters were, including major reporters, were assigned to Iowa. They were up all night on television just chit-chatting because no votes were being counted. The vote counting system completely collapsed, and that was run by the Democratic Party. On Tuesday night, you had a spectacular State of the Union message by the president, just well orchestrated, and the Democrats looked like fools, including the Speaker of the House, who tore up the president's speech while he was still on the platform as he was finishing, an act of pettiness of unbelievably low proportions. I mean, just tacky. You had a Democratic Party sitting in the halls of Congress listening to the speech, not even applauding national heroes. Again, Trump derangement syndrome. Anything the president says, we are against. It doesn't matter. And then you had the women in white, who apparently was celebrating women's suffrage. When was women's suffrage adopted? I think about a century ago. Apparently, they're still going to the party, you know, celebrating women's suffrage. Right. I mean, these are things from the 1960s. This is a party that is a half century out of date. Then, of course, we had Wednesday when the president was acquitted by a substantial vote in the United States Senate. Then we had Thursday when the aftermath of all this was beginning to be felt, and you had all the excuses and all the pledges by the Democrats that they're going to double down, they're going to continue their investigation, and it just went on like this. And then you had Friday, which revealed in New Hampshire a debate among the Democrats showing how divided they are as a party. They seem to have nothing to do with the country, actually, but only to do with the disputes within their party. This was not a week any party would want to repeat.
No, and honestly, I think they are going to have more weeks like this, because this is a party that it used to be a left-of-center party, which is different than what we have now.
Yes.
I mean, it's one thing to be left-center. That's fine. I mean, the Republicans are right-center, and there's your balance. But this is not a party. I mean, when Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, is talking in whatever he was talking, and they ask him about pro-life Democrats, and he says, no, this you have to be pro-choice to be in this party. I mean, is that insane or what? I mean, that's just completely idiotic. I mean, he's discarding. I mean, how many people are pro-life? Half of the country is, Bill.
Yes, and that is something that will come back and haunt him. It will be used all around the country, especially in the South and in the Midwest. This is, you know, there's a rule of politics, a rule of sports: never take points off the board. In other words, if you have a choice of getting points or getting an extra down or something, keep the points on the board. And here is a guy who's taking points off the board. Basically, he's saying to people who already vote Democratic, we don't want you unless you agree with us on this issue. Well, that's madness. That's madness. You can still be pro-life and be a member of a party that is mostly pro-choice, but he basically said, we don't want you. I don't know what is wrong, but what is wrong is seriously wrong.
Right. Well, but it seems to me, Bill, that this whole abortion debate has changed in the last 3 or 4 years, because it used to be, and to President Clinton's credit, you know, he used to say, well, you know, abortion should be legal but very rare. You know, it should be kind of, you know,
safe,
rare.
Rare.
Yeah, exactly. But now we've gone to an extreme where it's not, I mean, it should be, it's no longer, it should be legal, but it's a different attitude. Now abortion can happen at any time in the pregnancy, and that's simply not, I can tell you that's not going to work with Hispanic women who, if you look at the polling data, they represent the strongest anti-abortion bloc in the country. African Americans are not exactly crazy about abortion either, based on some of the polls I've seen. So I this is stupid. I mean, for a party to do something like that, and he wasn't the only one. Every candidate who appeared in that forum, it was, I think, a forum of reproductive rights, basically said the same thing, Bill.
Yes. Well, it's this is the descent into madness of what used to be a great political party, the Democratic Party. I mean, this is the party of Roosevelt and Truman and Kennedy. It was also, by the way, a party of segregation. We should, let's not forget that. But when you look at the giants in the history of the Democratic Party, the presidents it produced, and then look at it today. I mean, it's pathetic. There is not one of those people running for president who I would feel comfortable putting in the White House. And I think back to 1960, when I was a young intern for a great Democratic liberal senator named Paul Douglas, war hero, severely wounded on Okinawa, and one of the great men of Congress. And I look at the quality of those people. I look at the fact that in 1960, every single candidate for the Democratic nomination for president could have walked into the presidency the next day without missing a beat. That's how experienced they were. And the one who was considered the least experienced and the one they worried most about, and that Mrs. Roosevelt, the widow of Franklin Roosevelt, worried about publicly, was John F. Kennedy. He was actually considered the least qualified of all, and of course he won the nomination and won the presidency. But, I mean, the standards were so high. We had in the White House a man who had been a five-star general, who had been the organizer of liberty in Europe and victory in Europe. And you look at these people now. I mean, it's embarrassing. It really is embarrassing. And standards dropped very severely in the late 60s and through the 1970s, when the country, with incredible luck, and it was, I think, just luck of timing, the country found Ronald Reagan. And he went on to become a very, very important American president, in part because he restored the country's morale.
Mm-hmm. That's right. No, yes, absolutely. I remember that election of 1980. It was pretty incredible. But there you have, you know, the president's State of the Union. I agree with you. It was absolutely beautiful. I mean, it was just well delivered, and the way he brought in those different guests, I thought was just absolutely great. But apparently, Nancy Pelosi was angry that he didn't shake her hand. Now, when you look at the video, and you know, and I agree with you. I think sometimes Trump can be very rough too. I mean, this is not a you know, this is not a sweet person. This is not an amiable guy like Reagan was. But it's possible that he did not shake her hand. Although I don't think that's clear from the video. From the video, you look at it and you go, well, maybe he didn't see it because he didn't shake the. Well, he didn't shake the vice president's hand either.
That's right.
So if he was going to shake hands, he would have you know, gone to Vice President Pence. So she reacts the way she did. Then she spends the entire evening sitting there behind him, making all these stupid faces. She kept looking at, I guess, the women in white. And it's like you're sitting there saying, this is silly, absolutely silly. I remember
right.
Paul Ryan. I remember Newt Gingrich. I remember Tip O'Neill. None of them ever did anything like this before.
No, they would just sit there with a blank face.
Yes.
And they would
and
applaud
that's okay.
the things.
And
they'd
that's
applaud
okay.
the things they wanted. Yeah, that is perfectly okay. No, I think she's demeaned the office of Speaker. And I don't think they care, because she's now basically presiding over a party that really, down deep, doesn't regard itself as an American political party. They regard themselves as above that. You know, people said during the Obama administration, he's the first post-American president. Well, maybe he thought so, But the country didn't want to think so. I mean, nobody got the approval of the American people for such a conception. But that's the way they feel. And these two weirdos that we have in Congress now, who the one from Minnesota, Omar, who's got all her own legal problems, and the one from Michigan, Tiab, or whatever her name is, they both came in native garb. I mean, is this what is this, a costume party?
Right.
I mean, it's you don't come in native garb. This is the United States of America, and we come dressed as Americans. But I mean, that's they feel themselves to be very special, very superior, not like those rubes out there. It's a very, very sad state of affairs. And yet, when election day comes, we know one thing. Whoever is nominated by the Democratic Party, whether that person is living or dead, will have the support of the American press. And that support
yes.
means something, especially in a close election.
Absolutely. But I thought it was interesting. You mentioned these ladies in white. I thought it was quite a contrast. You know, you had on the Republican side, you had people dressed in appropriate attire, you know, the business suit or the ladies in their you know, business dresses or whatever. And then you look at the Democrat side, all these ladies in white. I just thought it was appalling. I mean, what are they? I mean, what issue bothers them that they would all dress like that? And of course, Nancy Pelosi herself was dressed in white. But another thing too that really bothered me watching the State of the Union. Here's that little 9-year-old girl who gets a scholarship. Now you would think that everybody would be happy about that. The Democrats do not stand up to recognize that young girl and
no.
her mom.
No.
Amazing.
Well, you know, because she was an African-American, and you are not supposed to, as an African-American, accept services from Donald Trump. I mean, or had anything to do with Donald Trump or anything to do with the Republican Party. You're considered Uncle Tom. I mean, this is the way they've been taught to think. Now, fortunately, I don't think most African-Americans do think that way. And there are, in fact, indications by some polls that that Trump will get a larger percentage of the African American vote this time than he got last time, possibly by quite a bit. And if that is true, and if it is true that the polls taken in the Hispanic community show increased support for Trump, and if that turns out to be true, this could be real trouble for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and the numbers, Bill, as we've discussed before, you know, President Trump does not need 25% of the vote. If he took it from 9 to 18 or double it from 9 to 18, that would be huge. And on the Hispanic side, if he took it from 27 to 33 to 34, 35, that would be huge too. So he doesn't need to, you know, it's not like he's already won with the numbers that he got in 2016. So anything over that is, as they say, gravy. But then came the acquittal day, the day of the acquittal, and there's two people who really disappointed me that day. One is Senator Romney, who I voted for Senator Romney. I've always liked him. I thought he's a very fine man, very decent guy, but I thought his whole reasoning was completely nutty. I mean, that President Trump had violated the public trust, and I couldn't buy it. I couldn't buy it. I don't want to say that he did it because he hates Trump or because he's angry at the election. I mean, I don't want to go that far, but I still have to say that I was disappointed with his vote. The other disappointment, Bill, was Senator Manchin.
Yes,
he is.
Very much so.
He gives a speech calling for censure, saying that impeachment is a bad idea, and then he turns around and he votes to convict. Made no sense to me, Bill.
Well, I think the only thing that we can say is he's decided not to leave the Democratic Party. And there's been talk over the years that he would leave and become a Republican because that's where his heart is. But he's decided apparently not to leave, possibly because of seniority issues, and that he knew that if he did not go along with the party would discipline him. I mean, people talk about Trump being intimidating within his party, and he is, and making threats and engaging in retribution, which he does, sometimes in a big way, sometimes in a small way. But the same thing goes on, maybe even more viciously, in the Democratic Party. I mean, how would you like to be a Democrat in Congress who stands up and says, I'm pro-life? They, you'd be massacred. You'd probably be primaried immediately by AOC from New York with LaVita from the Bronx, who I think did not show up at the speech. I think she was probably too traumatized to show up at a speech she disagreed with.
Right. Now, she's about as nutty as it gets. But Doug Jones in Alabama voted to convict. But I think that was just more or less he figures, I'm going to lose anyway. So what difference does it make whether I lose by 10 points or 30? I'm going to lose anyway. I might as well keep my connections in Washington so I can do something later.
I think that's probably true.
So I think that was simply a case of self-preservation. The other guy, John Tester in Montana, now I'm surprised we're not hearing more about him because that's a pretty Republican state too, Bill.
Yes, he still voted to convict. I think that they were in such trouble within their party. Or maybe they did some polling and it turned out, I don't know when Tester was up for re-election, but maybe they did some polling and said it wouldn't really hurt them that much. But I think this is very much an internal party thing. The Democratic Party is becoming internally crazy. They turn on each other very easily. You have little AOC saying, I'm going to arrange primaries for people I disagree with. And I'm hoping that in November we have, in the United States, a Boris Johnson-style victory, and that the Democratic Party is essentially demolished, and that a new party take its place. Now, that hasn't happened in Britain. The Labour Party is trying to rebuild after a devastating defeat at the hands of Johnson and the Conservatives, but I hope that's where we wind up, because the Democratic Party really does need to be replaced. I don't think it can be reformed.
No. No, I don't think so either. Now, the day after acquittal, President Trump, I guess, took a victory lap, I guess, in that press conference or that little speech that he gave. And I kind of got the feeling, Bill, I want to get your reaction, but I kind of got the feeling from that presentation by President Trump and that he's not done. He's going to go after some of these people that impeached him or put him in this place. And he's got a lot of things that he's going to do against them. Maybe that's not good for the country, but that's where he's at right now. I think President Trump, and you know he already fired, I guess, that general, and then he fired the ambassador, and then everybody's reacting, and it's like, you know, gee, I guess Trump is the only executive in the world who cannot fire people who are not loyal to him, Bill.
That's right. Look, I think could he have done better at that press conference by extending at least some hand of friendship to his opponents? Yes, and I think he should have. He is very vindictive. He's, you know, they used to say about President Truman, he did the biggest things in the biggest ways and the littlest things in the littlest ways. The problem with Trump that I have, and I think other people have, even though I'm going to be supporting him, is that he does everything in the littlest ways. He doesn't have those moments of magnanimity, which are required, I think, required in politics. And they hurt him. It drives people away from him. And but yes, that's the way he is.
That's exactly right. And I just kind of get the feeling that there's more coming now. Senator Graham was saying that they're going to have hearings in the Senate regarding, you know, the FISA and all that kind of stuff. I have mixed feelings about this, Bill, because on one hand, I wish all this stuff would just stop because nothing is getting done. It just seems like the more we argue about these things, the more we're poisoning the well. So in many ways, I wish that everybody would just say, okay, let's stop this all this garbage and let's have like a peace treaty and let's do something else. But on the other hand, there are times when, you know, I like to see some of the people involved in some of this madness at least held accountable, Bill. So I'm back and forth on this, and some days I say, Trump, just stop it, but other days I say, no, Trump, go for it, because they didn't treat you very fairly. So I'm kind of back and forth on this, Bill.
I think many people are. You know, on the one hand, they want the truth to come out, but on the other hand, they want all this investigating to stop. Now, the Democrats have already announced that they have no intention of stopping, that they're going to investigate and just investigate. I think they're hoping to bring Trump down through this process, just wear him down to the point where he will not be reelected. I think they are hoping, most of all, to take over the U.S. Senate, where judges are confirmed, which would make it devastating for President Trump in his second term. It's just blocking and blocking and blocking. There's no affirmative stand on the part of the Democratic Party except for those stands that are so crazy that most of the nation would reject them.
Yes.
It is really a party that seems completely irrelevant to the American people.
Yes, I agree with you. But, you know, they still get their votes. And now, something about Iowa that I thought was interesting, Bill, is that the Democrat turnout was not what they thought it was going to be, Bill. So that should be a concern for the Democrats. And here in Houston, we had an election a couple of weeks ago where, you know, they brought in all the heavyweights. They brought in Beto and all the heavyweights. And the Republican won by 18 points. Now, true, it's a Republican district, but they were hoping that it would be a lot closer than that, and it wasn't, Bill.
Well, you know, it's each election and each primary election is now a major news story. How important they will be in the long run, I don't know. Whether it is any indicator of what will happen in November, I also don't know. I think at this point in the campaign of 1960, Jimmy Carter was beating everybody. And as it turned out, Jimmy Carter should have been calling moving vans because he was decisively beaten. So, this is all preliminary stuff. I think all the action right now is in the Democratic Party to see which of these unworthy people, and they really are unworthy in terms of the presidency, is going to get a presidential nomination. And you get the feeling, as you kind of suggested before, that no matter who he or she is, there's going to be opposition from within the party. And I think there's a possibility of a very, very dramatic Democratic convention with even the possibility of violence.
Yes, well, contested conventions, to be sure, because I don't think they're not going to have a candidate by the time they get there. So I really believe it'll be a very contested election. But what's interesting to me about the situation right now is that in Vegas, they're now saying that Trump has a 60% chance of being reelected. Now, that's a pretty good number. And
yes.
Vegas is a pretty reliable, it's not a poll, it's actually people investing their money, which is perhaps more serious than a poll because you don't have a sampling problem when people are investing, you know?
Yes.
But they're saying 60%, that's a pretty good number, Bill.
That is a very good number, and it dramatically reverses from what it was only months ago when the experts in Vegas thought the president might lose. Right now he's on a winning streak, but let's stress something. The election is 9 months away.
Right.
That's 3 lifetimes in politics.
Right, and he does have a tendency sometimes to make mistakes. Let's say it in a nice way. He does have sometimes the tendency to say things and make mistakes that could hurt him with some of the independents who are basically going to decide the election. Well, let's talk about one more thing, Bill, here, and that's New Hampshire coming up either Monday or Tuesday. I think it's Tuesday night. Yeah, Tuesday night, yeah. And the amazing thing to me about New Hampshire is whatever happened to Vice President Biden? I mean, he is now in fourth place in some of these polls. Now, some of the experts are saying that half of the people have not decided, so these polls could be totally different when people go out. When people actually vote, the results could be different. But if he comes in the fourth place, like the polls are saying, he may be done. I mean, I really do believe that he may be done as a candidate, Bill, and that means that it's going to be, I guess, Bernie Sanders or Mayor Pete, the nominee, Bill.
Well, you know, isn't that interesting? The Biden thing, I think, is coming as a direct result of people actually seeing him on television and seeing that he really is an old man, and he forgets. He has gaffes all over the place. He makes these foolish remarks about people not being wanted in the party. He does not seem to be in line with his party anyway. You know, being Barack Obama's vice president doesn't seem to have any cachet of any kind, because so many in the party now regard Obama as old time. You know, we want something to the left of Obama now. And he just seems to be the guy who can't get a break, maybe not deserve a break, and it's possible he can fall by the wayside. And then you've got, as you just said, Bernie Sanders, a socialist, who spent a good part of his career showing sympathy for America's enemies. And then you've got Pete Buttigieg, who is the mayor of some village called South Bend in Indiana and has absolutely no experience on the national stage or with foreign or defense policy, and a man whose qualifications for the president are essentially non-existent. And that, yes, that's what they can be left with. Oh, but there is the 900-pound gorilla in the room, and that's Mike Bloomberg, simply
right.
Because he has so much money. And you don't know at this point. You almost sit around every day in American politics now waiting for some surprise, waiting for something you know is going to happen, but you don't know exactly what it is that will happen. But it's possible that Bloomberg can buy his way out of this. He bought a third term in New York. And, you know, he is so well-financed through his own fortunes that he might, and by the way, through some good political acumen, that he might be able to buy the nomination. I doubt it, by the way, because I think the opposition will be so ferocious,
mm-hmm.
so emotional. I mean, how can we, the Democratic Party, allow a man in who voted for George W. Bush in 2004 and is now running for the Democratic nomination and is not even really a Democrat, and he might get it by simply buying it? I think a lot of people in the party will really revolt over that.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, but my gosh, I mean, his ads are everywhere.
Yes,
you cannot
that's what
watch.
They say.
Yeah, you cannot watch a national channel without seeing his ads. I mean, during the Super Bowl and during the football season, I mean, it was just his ads were all over the place. Now, New Hampshire will be followed by Nevada and South Carolina, and then, of course, Super Tuesday. So my guess is that we could get to Super Tuesday, which is in March. Have so many different – I mean, you could have like three or four different candidates win three or four different primaries, and then it really becomes a mess after that because –
It sure does.
Because then there's no way – I mean, then it's going to be a contested election. I mean, a contested convention, because
yes.
nobody
now,
will have the time to make up the delegates.
Well, you know, I don't know what the convention rules are. And those convention rules might suddenly become very, very important, because I believe that delegates to the convention are required on certain ballots to vote for the person who, in effect, they won for. You know, you're running as a Sanders delegate or you're running as a Biden delegate. But I do believe that after a certain number of ballots at a national convention – and I imagine it differs slightly from party to party, that they are released from that burden, and they can vote for anybody they wish. Now, there also may be a provision, I don't know, but I think there would almost have to be, where after a certain number of ballots, new candidates can be proposed. You know, we
right.
could have a situation where they go to the convention, and none of the people who they came in with gets the nomination. And that, of course, what name immediately comes to mind? Hillary Clinton.
Right, right. No, I know. It could be as crazy. It'll certainly keep us talking for the next few months, Bill.
Well, I think we're going to have plenty to talk about. And remember, you can't predict the future. And
right.
people try. There are all these predictors out there. At Urgent Agenda, we never make predictions. And
right.
the reason is because, first of all, it has to be brought up, even though it's sad to be brought up, but there's the reality of biology.
Yes.
I mean, these are some of the people running are really old for first time for candidates for the presidency. And even if they weren't, there's also, God forbid, the possibility of a violent act. Something can happen internationally, and something can happen to the economy. People
right.
forget that in 2008, 6 weeks before the voting, we had a national economic collapse of markets. And that probably cost John McCain the election, because McCain was not doing badly at all. And I still wonder to this day, I know nothing about it, I have no proof, But I still wonder to this day whether there was a manipulation of markets. You
right.
have people like George Soros on the Democratic side who know how to do these
mm-hmm.
things. And I just wonder whether at the last minute something will happen.
Well, I mean, going back to 2008, if you remember, McCain came out of the convention pretty strong because of Sarah Palin. And after the first debate, he had a one-point lead in the
yes,
Real Clear Politics average. And then, of course, it all fell apart in October. Well, Bill, let's close tonight by remembering something that happened 56, it's incredible, 56 years ago tonight. The Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show, and it was, I don't know, it's become almost like the biggest thing of the 1960s. I don't remember it personally because I was in Cuba at the time. You were in New York. What do you remember of the Beatles that night, Bill?
Well, there is the image, of course, of them coming off the plane. That is
yes.
the continuing image and, you know, arriving in America, staking their claim. They were breaking through as a music group. Ed Sullivan was the leading television variety show host. We don't have variety shows anymore, but
no.
variety show host, and he was going to present them that night. And the memory that everyone has is not of their performance. Nobody remembers what their performance was. It was all the girls screaming in the audience.
Yes.
And you can be sure that they were put there. I mean, I don't think that was the regular Ed Sullivan audience. They probably reserved a certain number of seats to just grab girls off the street or knew them or whatever. And they were supposed to sit there and scream. And they did sit there and scream. And that, of course, is the image that the public had, that this was a tremendously popular group with a new sound, with tremendous appeal to teenage females. And that's what we came away with, and they were introduced to America. Very large audience ratings that night. As I said earlier in the evening, there's a kind of trivia game that is played. The people
that's
are
right.
asked, who else appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show that night? Now, if I remember, there were some pretty big people, but nobody actually remembers who appeared
right.
with the Beatles that night. It was one of the big nights in the history of the television industry.
Well, 73 million people watched the show,
mm-hmm.
which I would assume in 1964 that was a huge number,
because
we did not have. You know, it wasn't until I saw this the other day. It wasn't until 1969 that the U.S. population passed 200 million.
Right.
So this happened 5 years before. So I mean, 73 million. You probably had 70 or 75% of the television sets in the country watching this.
That's right.
I guess another trivia question that I would ask, I don't know the answer, but I'm going to try to find out. What was the show on NBC and what was the show on ABC that night? Because CBS, because you only had three networks back then. So you had Ed Sullivan on CBS, and I don't know what was on NBC, what was on ABC. It would be fun to find out because – who else? I mean, what other shows were people watching other than the Beatles? That would be interesting, Bill.
I think it would be interesting. And remember, most of the people watching were watching on black and white sets.
Absolutely. And it was one television in every home. That's the other thing.
Yes.
So you had this television set in the living room and everybody watching it. And I think that was, you know more about this than I do, Bill, but to me, that was the success of Ed Sullivan, that he had something for everybody.
That's right. Do you happen to know, Sylvia, what date that was in 1964?
Yeah, February the 9th. It was exactly, it was tonight, February the 9th. So exactly
19,
today.
Yeah. That's
so
right.
It was, it was literally today, about this time, I guess. It was 8 o'clock Eastern time when the show started.
Yes,
and
that was... That was less than 3 months after President Kennedy's assassination.
Well, yeah, some people have tried to make a connection saying that the country needed something like the Beatles after that. Maybe so, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yes, it was on this day, February the 9th, 1964. It was a Sunday night. And another interesting detail, only two of the Beatles are still around. You know, John Lennon, of course, was killed, and George Harrison died of cancer. So
yes.
Only two of them are still around. Ed Sullivan, of course, passed away many years ago.
Yes.
And so it would be fun. It would be fun to find out what was on the other channels. And it would be fun to find out who else was on the show that night. I'm gonna do a little homework, Bill.
Okay, that would be interesting. I think I'll do the same homework and find. I'm interested now that you mentioned it. But it was a great night in television history, and people forget 1964. I mean, that's early, relatively early television. Network television was only about 14 years old because we didn't have the coaxial cable until the early 1950s. You had programs on both coasts, but what they would do is they would produce in New York, go on live like your show of shows, and it would be kinescoped, which means basically a film of the show, which was taken right off a television screen, and that was flown immediately to Los Angeles and broadcast in Los Angeles from that source. We didn't have real national television until the early 50s.
Right. It's just when you watch that Beatles show, I mean, you could tell how much TV has changed. I mean, it's just remarkable. Black and white, of course, and they didn't have as many cameras. And it's fun to watch just for that reason, to see how far we've come. On the actual television show, the techniques, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, the technology
show.
Is incredible. I don't know if the content is
that's good.
Although
well, that's another
most
topic.
Countries, most people in the country lived in cities where they had like three television channels. And in New York, we were the biggie. We had something like a 7 or 9, whatever it was. But today, I mean, people routinely have several hundred.
Quite
a remarkable difference.
No, it really is, and I don't know how people find time to see 200 channels, but I guess that's another topic for another day. But, Bill, as always, thank you so much for your time and for your insight, and we'll just figure – I mean, we'll have a lot to talk about the next time.
Oh, we're going to have a lot to talk about for the rest of the year, I think.
That's right. Thank you so much, as always, and keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda. We like to check it every day. It's great work, and thank you so much for it.
Thank you very much, Silvio. Looking forward to next week.
All right. Good night, Bill.
Good night.
Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We always chat with Bill on Sundays. Have a good time. Enjoy a few things. I thought tonight it was fun to go back and remember the Beatles. Bill was, of course, in New York when that happened, and I was not. I was still living in Cuba when that happened. But it was fun to hear what Bill had to say. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.